Okay, then. Yes?
The Dalai Lama, who I don't usually take issue with, he translates the gate as a verb.
Yes.
And let me just read it and tell me if you think it is essentially different than your translation. Essentially different. Go beyond, go totally beyond, be rooted in the ground of enlightenment. Is that essentially different than your translation in essence?
I don't know. Go. What I'm doing is I'm trying to recognize that there's a clue in the grammar that is significant. That the case ending in the word gate gives you three options, and one of those options it means into the gone. And again, given that this is
he's translating it as a verb, you're translating it as a prepositional phrase.
Well, yeah, you might say that. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's a verb. It is. But it's a verb with a case ending.
Okay.
Yeah, we can't do that in English. We have to have prepositions. But in Sanskrit and other there's a lot of languages with case endings. We don't have them in English. Latin has case endings. I think Japanese has case endings.
No.
Well, anyway, some languages do. So when you, as a translator, you're stuck with a situation where there's a case ending indicating a direction, and we don't have the ability with the verb alone to indicate that. We can indicate the action, but then we have to add a direction. And so that's why mine's a little different. Yes?
This business of true, not false, seems so dualistic. And in the translation that we chant, it's is truth, not mere formality. And it seems to me like to say that this is true elevates emptiness to a concept. And so it somehow seems a misstep to claim that it has general applicability, that one can infer a constant principle of emptiness that is applicable to all situations, because that changes it to a concept.
This doesn't refer to emptiness. It refers to the mantra.
Okay.
The mantra is true. The mantra is true.
So same question about the mantra then. What does it mean to be true?
Functional. It heals all suffering. That's its truth.
And how is that different from false?
False would be not heal from suffering. In short, truth is defined by its function. Yeah, to do otherwise would be to do what you say, to create a separation of into making something into an object. And thus giving it characteristics, say that's true, that's false.
But isn't that a duality?
It is true that truth and false is a duality, but not if you're in the womb of Prajnaparamita. In the womb of Prajnaparamita, again, this is Prajna, before knowledge. And you might say what this phrase is doing is saying this is what's going to happen if you do this right. This is like if you actually are able to follow the instructions, you will be relieved of suffering. David?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Both the Sanskrit and the Chinese are instructive here. It's not true-false as in a proposition can be judged as true or false. The word satya in Sanskrit, which is here, and then in Chinese as well, the phrasing is, means more something. It's actual, it's real, it's a fact. In that sense of truth, like this really works. It's not like true-false as in a proposition, in a logical sense. It's different, you know, satya.
Yeah.
So I like your rendering.
Yo, I like that explanation. Yes, Rick?
It seems to me there's this ongoing theme, which is non-attachment.
Yes.
And in this case, it's non-attachment to objectification of things around us, concepts, and not being so caught up in this mental net that you were talking about.
Yes.
So I guess the theme that I see is just non-attachment. So that there's a liberation by not being all wrapped up in subject-object relationship or duality or this separation which comes through all these mental processes.
Yeah, and that's why if we think about these things, we're just going to end up caught up in them again. And that's why this particular sutra gives us with this little trick at the end. Here's a mantra. Just say that. Just say that. And it does have some meaning, and yeah, you could think about the meaning if you want, but that meaning will just emphasize that you're going into a space where there's no concepts, into the prajna, into the cloud of unknowing. Yes?
This reminds me a lot of, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce his name right, the Korean Zen master, Sasanim.
I don't know how to pronounce it either.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, he said, only don't know mind is before thinking is primary point.
Oh, well, yeah, that's prajna. Yes?
How might we incorporate this into our life? I mean, it's I love this stuff, but it's awfully kind of, you know, intellectual or mental. I mean, in your book, do you give some exercises for non-self or?
No. I don't go there. I'm a translator. I'm not a teacher. I mean, there are teachers who really know how to, like their physicians, they know how to help you. I write the book about medicine, you might say, but I'm not. I don't work in a clinic. almost all Buddhists use meditation. There's meditation is never wrong. There might be something better. Chanting this mantra is what is suggested here, and you can do that whether you're walking, sitting, standing, or lying down, or meditating. So that's what the sutra teaches. That's its instruction. But, yes.
In your introduction, you talk about the sutra as it's as much a work of art as a work of religion.
Yes.
And you haven't said much about that. I just wonder if you'd just speak for a minute about the relationship between art and religion and how the sutra works as art.
It's just a feeling, you know. You see a painting, you say, "Wow, that's, I like that." I guess I call this a work of art because it's so beautifully structured. Mm-hmm. It encapsulates so much without showing any signs of effort. It doesn't seem to be trying to do all this, but it does so much. And I was really impressed with that. And that's what art does to me. It's just, I'm not lost in the brushstrokes. Or even worried whether blue is the right color here. That's why I called it a work of art. Yeah, yes.
I'm sort of nervous to ask this question, but the word suffering in Sanskrit, does suffering, I mean, is that the closest translation, and is suffering different from the feat of healing hurt or grief or sex abuse or your kid being murdered? I mean, how does that translation for the word suffering, is that the real word? I mean, is that the best word from the Sanskrit? And is suffering
it's about, yeah, it probably is. That's why almost all translators have used it. There have been people, and you know, reliable translators have used the word unease, and thus you could use the negative dis-ease or disease. It indicates a disharmony. Yeah, disharmony could be also used. I would say if you were not going to use the word suffering, you could use any of a dozen other words, but you'd want to be you want to use it in a certain context. I mean, another word might be appropriate in another context. This sutra is being very ambivalent about, it's not creating any special contexts. And therefore, I stuck with the standard use of suffering. And those situations you just itemized all sound like suffering to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what other word would be a better one.
Affliction.
What?
Affliction.
Well, no, affliction, the Buddhists use affliction a lot for something else, for like the kleshas, the our passions and attachments. But that feeling of suffering, again, that's why the Buddhism and Buddhists are only interested in the mind and in this arrow that is stuck in our hearts and getting rid of that arrow. And that's why Buddhism isn't really a philosophy about the cosmos. Buddhism doesn't include a cosmology. It's not interested in an ontology about what is really real. It all begins with our suffering and tries to figure out how to make the pain stop. Of our knowledge of our own personal lives and the inevitable death that we all are going to encounter, the death of our loved ones and all the traumas and tragedies that we encounter and we see others encounter. And so faced with this, Buddhism is an attempt to figure this out in a way that we can be free of this. Yes?
So, based on that, is that saying that if one was to implement this effectively, that one would not experience suffering like she described?
Yeah, well, no, you would still experience suffering.
Okay.
It's just you could let it go. To not feel suffering is to be uncompassionate.
Oh, so that's not being implied, to not feel the suffering.
Everybody feels suffering, and even people who practice a lot feel suffering, but they're able to let it go and to recognize it is a passing cloud. But you have to recognize the clouds, because they have important meaning for us in our lives. I mean, if I don't feel my suffering, I might become gravely ill. If I start feeling a pain in my side and I just ignore it, you might say, or I don't feel it, then I'm not going to live very long. And if you don't feel the suffering around you, you have no way of helping other people either. So I've never heard of people who don't feel suffering. Unless, of course, they could have some physical malady, or even a mental malady that prevents them from feeling suffering. But I think that's not the path of cultivation. It's a path of some strange karma. Yes, sir.
I'll be here.
Yeah.
Can you say what's the relationship between what's seen through in line 25, if they're seen through Nirvana, and then what's realized on 28? Some yoga.
Say that again?
What's the relationship between the two? So it's not Nirvana that's realized in 28, because that's seen through in 25. So what is Anuttara Samyak Sambuddhi? What's its relationship to the Nirvana in 25?
Cup of tea? Have a cup of tea? Time for tea? I don't know.
Good point.
He was asking, what is the difference between nirvana and enlightenment? Because the sutra says we should see through delusions, including the delusion of nirvana, but yet if we cultivate this, we will realize, like all Buddhas, we will realize enlightenment.
And what's the difference between realize and attain?
Attain means there's a distinction between subject and object. It's the objectification, whereas realize, and even the English word realize means to become.
Okay.
And so realization means there's some experience that somehow transforms us. Realization is sort of suggests a transformation rather than an attainment.
An effort.
Yeah, an effort.
Okay.
But nirvana is almost always looked at, well, the word itself is a negative. Nir is a negative prefix in Sanskrit, and there's lots of interpretations of what the vana means. Usually it's no breath, no desire, something like that. It's usually means death. It's usually associated with the end of life. Whereas enlightenment has nothing to do with a dialectic of life and death. It's about the knowledge that is no knowledge.
Interesting.
but it's something, it's a good question to keep in mind. Yes?
It's kind of what you said last. It's about that process or that state of being in the womb where you're before knowledge. Is that similar to the idea of just being it is as it is, and you therefore have no concepts or no fears or no judgments or anything of it because it just is as it is and there's no meaning, there's no... Is that the type of thing you're talking about, being in the womb before knowing?
Sort of.
Okay.
But when you're in the womb, all of that disappears.
Yeah.
It's just like a baby is in the womb. In the womb, the idea that you're living in a conceptual world disappears. Because we get these concepts from our parents when we're ripped out of the womb and the society in which we live, and suddenly we're in this state that we have created by chanting the mantra, that whereby we are in the womb of Prajnaparamita, and now what? And it's a process that it takes time, and we all have different karmic paths. Things that we all have to let go are different, and some people might take lifetimes to achieve what others can achieve within hours or days. The time is not important.
Yeah.
Remember that, the fifth element? That time is not important. Only life important.
It may be a small a distinction without a difference, but I've seen the Parasan Gate, spelled as S-A-M often.
Yeah, but S-A-M or N. Sometimes when Sanskrit is Romanized into Arabic or Roman letters, it's usually an N with a dot underneath it. But that pronunciation is more like our M sound. And so that some people, and I'm one of them, sometimes I'll have an N and sometimes I'll have an M. But I don't. My typewriter doesn't have an N with a dot under it, and I don't have a text on my computer. I don't have the Sanskrit type so that I can put an N with a dot under it. So that's why it could be an N or an M.
I'm just wondering if maybe I misunderstood you earlier. I kind of heard that the mantra at the end as being separate from the rest of the sutra, and I guess I'd always thought of the mantra as kind of a summation of the sutra.
Yes, both. Yeah. It's the end of the sutra. It does. It summarizes all the concepts of the sutra. Well, it does and it doesn't, because I mean, the mantra doesn't have anything about the Abhidharma, for example. But when you, it just tells you what you have to do, having gone through these statements, this teaching. So
I guess I thought it was as kind of saying you've seen through these categories,
yes.
These distinctions.
Yes, and therefore you're ready now to go into the womb of Prajnaparamita. So it's the culmination of this, of the sutra, the conclusion. And it does summarize it in the sense that if you're in the womb, then you've got all of these the whole sutra is encapsulated in it. No eye, no near. You don't have any eyes or ears in the womb. You don't have any, the skandhas, it all disappears in the womb.
Bill, I think we could take one more question if there is one more, as far as time goes.
This one, this is more personal for you. You were 4 years in a monastery, right? And I'm just fascinated with the differences in culture from that part of the world and the Western world. I think that's a big reason why a lot of people come here and are interested in this. What was it like for you personally to cut off from the Western lifestyle and to be, boom, you're in the monastery and now what do I do? Cup of tea.
Well, it was like being in the womb. Well, first of all, I had learned Chinese at Columbia, and I decided I wanted to quit my PhD program and go live in a monastery. So Japan did not seem to be the appropriate place. Up to that time, if you were a Westerner interested in Zen, you would go to Japan. but I didn't know any Japanese. I had no Chinese, but that was 1972. That was the middle of the Cultural Revolution in China. Mm. I couldn't go there. So it was Taiwan or nothing. Uh-huh. Maybe Hong Kong was a possibility. Anyway, one of my fellow graduate students had been to Taiwan and had the address of a monastery. So I just wrote them a letter. And they said, yeah, come on over. And so I went on over, and I arrived with $13 in my pocket. And, well, actually, I had $213. My dad gave me $200 extra when I was standing in line to take the plane to Taiwan. So I had $213 in my pocket, and they just took complete care of me. It was like being in a sanitarium. That's what monasteries are.
How old were you, and what was the first year like?
Well, I was 28, and they had never seen a Westerner before. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were a Westerner, you went to Japan, they just plugged you into the system. Mm. And they had it all organized in Japan, but the Japanese are very different from the Chinese. The one monastery I stayed at for 2.5 years, when I got there, the abbot, he was the leading Zen master in China, in Taiwan at the time, just picked up a stick and banged it on a rock and said, "You hear that?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "That means it's time to eat." And he said, "If you have any other questions, just ask." And in 2.5 years, I never had a question that I couldn't think of an answer for. A question worth bothering him about. I'd think of a question, and maybe in a couple of days I'd sit on it, and then an answer would come. So I'm not going to bother him about that. So, I lived there for 2.5 years. But the nice thing about living in these settings is you're totally free of everything. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to pay any money. I didn't need any money. I had total freedom. They gave me a little room. All vegetarian meals are really good. Great cooking. And it was in a mountain, so I could walk around the mountain and stuff. It was a lovely place. I used to meditate on this grave mound that was on the mountain. A really nice setting. It was lovely. But after 2.5 years at that second monastery, the abbot sort of said, "Well, you know, we've been taking care of you for a while. Isn't it time to become a monk?"
Yeah.
And, of course, I left a few weeks later. because I was very grateful for that period. And it's a wonderful opportunity to live in a monastery like that. I don't know whether... I know I would not have done well in Japan because I was in the Army. And when I got out of the Army, I was barred from reenlistment. I was a terrible soldier. I hate authority. I hate organizations. I just bristle at them. And if I had gone to Japan, I would have gotten pissed off, and it would have been counterproductive for a Buddhist practice. So the Chinese just took great care of me, you know, and they let me do my own thing. And so what I started to do, because I had all this time, I'd meditate about 4 hours a day. And I still had all these other hours. I started studying Chinese Buddhist texts, and I would find Buddhist texts in Chinese for which there were English translations, and I would see how the translator worked. And I would see it in English, and then I would see what the Chinese was for that, and I'd see that. And after a while, I said, "You know, I could do this." And I didn't mean to say that I was going to do it to improve upon the translation, but as a way of learning Chinese. Mm-hmm. I put away the English translation, look at the Chinese, and I would try to do a paragraph, and then I would see what the translator had come up with. And so I learned to be a translator like that, and then after a while I realized I loved translating. And the abbot gave me a book of Cold Mountain's poems one day. He had published himself, and he had pirated Burton Watson's English translations and put them on the back. So I could see what Burton Watson translated Cold Mountain, and then I started translating Cold Mountain. And then I, a little bit after that, I left the monastery and lived in this farming village for 14 years in Taiwan, up on this mountain. And then I found a publisher for my translations, and they said, "Do you have any more?" I've been translating ever since. And so I use translation as my practice, because I've discovered if I want to study a text, if I try to translate it, I really can understand it. if you just if I read the Heart Sutra, I'll get something out of it. But if I try to translate it, then I'll spend months or even a couple of years on a text, trying to understand it. So that's what I do. I'm a translator. Well, thank you very much for coming today.
Let me make just a couple of brief comments in conclusion. One, some members of the local Buddhist community and others in town have asked if there was an opportunity to present dana, which is a Buddhist word for offerings of contributions to our speaker. The college is supporting his visit, but I don't want to exclude the possibility of your generosity. So there is on a table right there in the aisle before the door a brown box that has little slots in it. And if you would like to contribute to Bill, who does not get a salary, he makes money off the royalties of his books and an occasional talk here and there, and it's very simply, your generosity would be most gratefully accepted, and we'll pass on anything into the box to him, and that would be wonderful. Lastly, I want to thank everyone who helped put this event together, people with Bodhi Mind Center, people at Colorado College, people with Springs Mountain Sangha. It's really been great, the promotion of the event and the organization. Lastly, one thing. There is a sign-up sheet out on the table outside the door for Bodhi Mind Center, the Buddhist lay organization that I represent. If you're interested in Buddhist-related events in Colorado Springs, some which might not be held here, and therefore Colorado College wouldn't promote it, or we might not put in the paper, you can get on our email list, and we put out notices for all kinds of Buddhist events. We also have in our links, our resources link, links to other Buddhist groups in town, like Spring Mountain Sangha and other stuff like that. Also, we plan to put up eventually from this tape recorder here, which my friend Rick knows how to work, this recording of all Bill's talks onto our website, which is bodhimindcenter.org. So that can be a resource for you all. And lastly, I'd just like to say not only thank you to Bill for his wonderful talks here, but I'd like to mention, I won't give you a long list of his publications, but I mentioned he's a scholar. If you go to his Wikipedia page on Bill Porter, Google Bill Porter Red Pine, you'll find a long list of his texts there, translations of poetry, translations of Buddhist texts, essays, and this and that. He's quite a productive scholar, and you'll find really wonderful works there, and I recommend that you buy them for your own edification and for his financial support as well. And lastly, while Bill responded to the question about recommendations for how to apply these teachings into life by saying that he's a translator and not a teacher, one of the reasons I called him a sage is because in his own secret ways, I think he teaches without trying to be a teacher. And I think he models ways of putting this stuff into practice. And when he says, give a cup of tea, that was a very profound gesture that he's referring to. And I think one of the ways I'd like to summarize some of the points he made about the Heart Sutra in terms of how do you put all this complicated philosophy into mind. He talked about the ways that many of us play video games in our minds, so to speak. I think one of the ways we play video games, whether we're Buddhist or not, is by trying to think, well, how do we make life better and how do we get out of the crap that we're stuck in? And one of the messages of this text related to having a cup of tea is to try to get rid of the various ways in which we seek to escape the circumstances we're in to find something better. And one of the messages, I think, of this text is that you don't need to search elsewhere for the fulfillment that life offers. The teaching of emptiness is that there is no elsewhere. This is all that there is. And so one has to find a way of getting by with what we have here, assuming that you actually have enough. There's fullness right here and now. I'll end with a cute, maybe stupid pun. There's lots of room in the womb. Right here. Yeah. And that's one of the messages of emptiness. So please thank me one last time and join me in thanking Bill for his wonderful talk.